It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll wrap up our series on heroin in Wisconsin with a look at the growing use of special drug courts, which include addiction treatment alongside the usual crime and punishment.
We'll start things off with a related issue. Wisconsin is part of a national trend, and that is a booming growth in older prisoners.
900 of Wisconsin's 22,000 prison inmates are over 60. That's a big jump from about 10 years ago, and the number is expected to go up over time.
Stephen Richards joins us right now to talk about this trend. He is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh and a former convict himself. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to start out with the numbers. We heard the numbers here just a few seconds ago. 900 of Wisconsin's 22,000 prison inmates now are over 60. And a couple of things. First of all, how has that changed over the years? And the second part of the question, 900 out of 22,000 doesn't sound that serious right now.
Well, it's going to get more serious because in Wisconsin, we've increased the sentences, the length of sentence that prisoners receive, and which means you've got more people going to prison who are going to be there for a longer period of time. So you're going to have more elderly, more senior citizens dying in prison.
And right now, as we look at these numbers, what are some of the challenges facing the prison system in terms of caring for some of these elderly prisoners?
Well, the Department of Corrections, you know, they've been sued. They lost a lawsuit. They were sued by ACLU a number of years ago, I believe back in 2006, having to do with the lack of medical attention for women inmates. The DOC doesn't have the money for the doctors and the nurses, and they don't have the money to provide services for prisoners. So instead, and a lot of prison systems do this, they ration what medical services they may have. They delay, they deny prisoners prisoners don't get physicals. They don't get medical attention until they're really sick, until they've got cancer and they're dying. So if you deny or delay medical attention, it just becomes more expensive later on.
So when we start looking at numbers like that, when we start thinking about some of the implications of the medical problems that some of these elderly prisoners might be facing in the future, what sort of options are we looking at? I mean, we could dump a whole lot of money into the system, I suppose, and treat prisoners there. We could look at a way of somehow cycling elderly prisoners out of the system. Are those two options? Are there more?
Oh, there's more. I think first we have to look at simply reducing the sentences that all prisoners receive. I know the public, they don't realize it, but they hear a term like 5 or 10 years, and they don't think that's a big enough number. So instead, judges are handing out 20 and 30 and 40, and that's why the prison population is climbing and will continue to climb. So we need to reduce the prison population by simply giving shorter sentences. There's no reason why people should be doing 20 or 30 years in prison in a civilized country. If people had shorter sentences, they wouldn't be in prison when they were 60 and 70, and they wouldn't be dying in solitary confinement like they are now. So the other thing I would do is I would take a minimum security camp and convert that into a medical unit. And a lot of prisoners, both male and female, that are in maximum and medium security, these are prisoners in wheelchairs, prisoners with no legs. They're not going to run away. There's no reason to have them behind a wall or a security fence. We can move them to a medical unit at a prison camp where it'd be much cheaper to provide them with the nurses and doctors that they need.
As you look around the country, I imagine other states are facing similar problems, are they?
All across the country. And what most states are doing is, and this is what happens traditionally every time you have a recession and you have budget problems, is the reality is they start releasing prisoners. And that's easy to do. I mean, it's easy to find thousands of prisoners here in Wisconsin that we could reduce without danger to the public safety. And most of these prisoners, particularly the older ones, the ones in their 50s and 60s, you know, they're tired. They've been locked up a long time. They've slowed down. They could be released without any danger of violent offenses.
But on the flip side of that, it's only going to take one incident, and you're going to be right back where you started from.
Right. That's the political issue, is that politicians are afraid of showing mercy. They're afraid of showing any kindness to convicts because they're afraid it'll backfire. Well, you know, something else backfires, too, and that is when you don't have money to pay for K-12 or pay for universities, for that matter. That backfires, too. And, I would just say that here in Wisconsin, we're spending way too much money on prisons, and we have way too many people locked up.
So one of the options you brought up before, reducing the sentences that all prisoners receive, how does that help people who are in prison now? Do we simply shorten the time that they're serving now and let them go and set them free? Or
it's a case-by-case. You have to look at each prisoner separately, but we should have some criteria for reducing the prison population based upon their original sentence, what percentage of that they've actually served, and what chance they have of being successful when we release them from prison. And we can do that, and that's what they do state by state all across the country.
Is there any state in particular that is doing this really right, that really has found the answer for this, or is it just a variation of letting prisoners out?
Well, right now in California, what they've been doing is having prisoners, releasing them from prison to serve some of their time in county jails, and then the state prison pays the county jail. I don't think that's the best answer. I think we need to just take the chance on each prisoner. And yes, if you release 1,000 prisoners, you have a chance that one or two of them might, you know, rob a bank or do something that would embarrass a politician. I would argue whether you release them now or 6 months from now or a year from now, you still have the same chance. I mean, nobody does 100% of their sentence, or very few people do. So everybody really is being released early. It's just a matter of releasing them 6 months earlier.
So how do you get the public to support this idea? I think right now the prospect of releasing a lot of prisoners might not appeal to a good segment of the population.
Well, I think we have to educate the public that it's how do you want your tax money spent? And do you really want to spend $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year to keep elderly prisoners locked up in cages? Show them pictures of prisoners in wheelchairs with no legs, prisoners that are laying in beds because they can't walk, and that's costing us $40,000, $50,000 a year per inmate.
Well, Stephen Richards, I think we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Stephen Richards, criminal justice professor at UW Oshkosh.
We've got a related issue coming up next on Central Time. Our heroin series concludes with a look at drug courts and their use in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today is the last installment of our WPR news series on heroin use in Wisconsin. It's a crime, of course, to possess heroin in Wisconsin, and addicts also commit other crimes in order to support their habits. Now, for some, when they're arrested, instead of being thrown into jail, they end up in drug court. In the final installment of our heroin series, WPR's Gilman Halstead reports on the carrot-and-stick approach used by drug courts that many believe is part of the solution to the heroin epidemic.
The carrot drug courts offer is the chance to avoid being locked up and keep a felony conviction off your record. If you're accepted into the program, you have to plead guilty to a felony and attend weekly court appearances and treatment sessions and stay clean for 4 months based on weekly urine tests. If you do that, the felony's wiped off your record. It's what Dane County Drug Court Judge John Markson calls a smart approach to dealing with heroin addicts.
The theory is that their criminality is fueled by their drug addiction. And so if we can treat the addiction and remove the root cause of the problem, we're being smarter about how we deal with criminality.
The stick the judge uses is the felony hanging over the head of the heroin addict. If he violates the rules of the court too often, the charge he pled guilty to will be enforced and he'll end up in prison. And a smaller version of that stick is used throughout the program. Honesty is the key. Addicts aren't booted out of the program for using heroin as long as they don't lie about it. But if they challenge a positive drug test, they face a jail sanction. Here's Judge Markson doing just that to a participant who was set to graduate from the program in 2 weeks, but challenged his most recent positive drug test.
What's going on?
Nothing is going on. I'm not using. I
need to do something to wake you up to the realities of where we're at.
Okay, so you want me to lose my job?
Okay, that's enough. Your two-night jail sanction starts now. We'll see you back next week. Wow is right, and we'll deal with it. In fact, that's the third night. That's a three-night sanction.
Judge Martin, please.
Out three nights.
Immediate punitive sanctions like this on addicts work, according to supporters of drug courts, and the statistics bear it out. Nationally, 75% of drug court graduates don't commit any new crimes in the first 2 years following their completion of the program. But positive reinforcement is also key, and drug court participants get that each week they remain clean and a lot of praise when they graduate. Here's Judge Markson erasing 27-year-old Jamie Burkhalter's heroin possession charges.
As a result of what you've done in the program, you have earned the dismissal of those charges. So that's a real big deal, and you should be very proud of what you've done in that regard.
Burkhalter himself says it was counselors at the treatment center the court sent him to and the support of his girlfriend that helped him kick the habit.
I tried to quit numerous times. And it's going to continue to be a struggle. I'd probably be literally dead or in prison if it wasn't for her.
Another drug court graduate, Patrick Kempfer, has now been clean for 4 years. He says the addicts the program works for have to accept what it offers at face value and move on with their lives.
They want people to come in and by the time they leave not be an issue for society. They want you to respect your life enough to not throw it away, to not go to criminal activity, to not waste it using drugs, because they are aware that each using addict is like a little nuclear bomb that goes off and creates devastation in every direction. They're trying to minimize that by giving people an opportunity to care about their life.
Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And thanks for that story, Gilman.
Here with us now to discuss the techniques and outcomes of drug courts is Doug Marlowe, Chief of Science, Law, and Policy for the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard that report on drug courts and how they work in Wisconsin. Is this something that's really catching on around the country?
Oh, there are currently over 2,700 drug courts in the U.S., and there are drug courts in about 30 other countries. About 50% of counties in the U.S. have a drug court. So it is rapidly becoming the way of doing business in the criminal justice system.
And is this a case where I'm in the criminal justice system in this county here and I see this thing working somewhere else? Are people getting a lot of good word of mouth on the outcomes of these?
Oh, absolutely. There's been more research on drug courts than any other program in the criminal justice system. And the result of those positive outcomes has been more and more counties, you know, wanting to develop the model, looking for federal and state funding to develop their own models. So it's definitely spreading.
Now, we just heard from Gilman how these things work, but what is it that makes them work? What's behind their success?
For the last
many decades there has been a false dichotomy between punishing people for their drug addiction and treating them, between focusing on public health or public safety, treatment or punishment. And drug courts have basically said it's both. We are going to hold people accountable for their actions. There are going to be consequences, but we're going to use the power of the criminal justice system to keep people in treatment and get them the services they need. And so, like you said before, it's the carrot and the stick is the magic formula.
Were these a hard sell when they first came along because of that sentiment that you mentioned, that this is a system about punishment first and foremost?
Well, I think in the early years, in the late 80s and early 90s, they were seen as being, you know, sort of soft on crime and sort of like a hug-a-thug kind of a program. Nowadays, I think they're pretty much recognized as a very substantial type program. People are not getting a free break. They are being held accountable. Programs are actually pretty tough on people. People are supervised very closely. There's real accountability. So I think that criticism has pretty much faded over the last couple of decades.
I want to key in on a word you've used a few times now, accountable and accountability.
Right.
I've read in the past that not only does the public appreciate that idea and the courts themselves, but actually the people being charged actually get some buy-in when they're held accountable. Does the research back that up?
Absolutely. I mean, the most common thing you'll see at a drug court graduation is the offender thanking the officer that arrested them or thanking the prosecutor that, you know, tried to hold them accountable. They can't do it themselves. Addiction is a loss of control. People cannot make the right decisions. Their judgment's impaired. They're led by that drug. They need the external power, the leverage to hold them, and they really appreciate it.
Now, we've been talking about heroin over the course of the last week here in our WPR news series. How common are heroin and other opiates showing up in the drug courts?
Oh, I'd say that's probably the most fast-growing drug in drug courts. The prescription opiate epidemic is really growing mm-hmm. in this country, and a lot of people are becoming addicted to prescription opiates, and then when they can't afford them or can't get them anymore, they're moving to street heroin. And so I would say that's probably the drug that's rising the most.
Now, maybe I'm naive, but I guess I've always assumed that if I'm sent to prison for drug use and I'm addicted, I'm going to get some kind of treatment in prison. Does that happen at all?
Most people will not receive treatment in prison. The percentage of people that actually get treatment in prison is fairly small. In many prisons, the quality of the service is not very good. And basically, the average effects of treatment in prison are really very minimal. The important time is when the individual is back on the street, coming in contact with the people that are using, with the drugs, with the stresses of their lives. And so if you give them treatment in prison and then release them, they're going to return to drug use pretty rapidly. And they don't even go back to using drugs at the same rate as before they entered prison. They will usually use it at a higher rate after a period of incarceration. So the critical period is the time in the community.
Do we have a sense, numbers-wise, how it compares a heroin addict, say, who goes to prison, doesn't go through a drug court, versus a heroin addict who goes through drug court? What's the difference in likelihood that they're going to relapse and get addicted again?
Almost everybody returning from prison is going to relapse. I mean, it's like 85%
wow.
within the first 30 to 90 days, and it's 95% in a year. In drug courts, you know, I mean, on average, you're going to get a 15, 20, 25% reduction in relapse rates, you know, just in the first year. And then it usually grows from there. In terms of reducing crime, you know, some drug courts are cutting crime rates in half. Now, of course, there's a lot of drug courts out there. Not all are as effective as others. But on average, drug courts are cutting crime rates and cutting drug use 15 to 20%. You can take that to the bank.
And just in our last 30 seconds or so, are states policymakers looking at this and saying this is a good investment?
Oh, there are several states where the governor, legislature, and Supreme Court have all gotten together and said there shall be a drug court in every county, and not always the states that you might expect. States like, you know, Alabama and Georgia and Texas, drug courts as well as New Jersey. Drug courts are really catching on, and they're really being spread throughout the country.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Doug Marlow. He's Chief of Science, Law, and Policy for the National Association of Drug Court Professionals.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be talking about the war on cancer and why we seem to be losing it.
We'll also hear from a former inmate who spent 44 years in prison, 12 in solitary confinement, about why prisoners start protesting against the prison system.
And a former director for the U.S. Census Bureau will tell us how the census gets it wrong when it comes to classifying race in America.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This month, the state of Mississippi passed legislation legalizing homebrewing beer there. That means that homebrewing beer is now legal in all 50 states. And of course, Wisconsin has a strong beer culture and a homebrewing tradition of its own.
We're looking for your calls. Do you make your own beer? Why do you do it? What's been your biggest success as a homebrewer and maybe your biggest failure? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
Charlie Bamforth joins us now. He is a professor of brewing science at the University of California, Davis. He's also known as the Pope of Foam. Charlie Bamforth, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first things first, you're a professor of brewing science. You're also the Pope of Foam. So how should I be addressing you during this interview?
Try Charlie, that works.
Charlie?
Unless my mother's around, you have to be Charles then, you know, but there you go.
Well, let's start out with some history. We're going to be talking about home brewing and why people brew their own beer and sort of where we are now. But I want to go back in time and way back in time. And when did brewing beer begin? And how do we know that? I mean, people weren't leaving empty beer cans lying about, right?
No, but there's various archaeological evidence and so on. And basically, most of the evidence points to about 8,000 years ago in a region we refer to as the Fertile Crescent. It's the region around what is nowadays Iraq. And beer was produced accidentally. And when they discovered they could sprout grain and they could bake that into a bread and then crumble the bread in jars and it mixed with water and strange things happened to that liquid, and they got a warm and happy feeling. They decided to stop having a nomadic existence, and they stayed put while they grew all the grain and did all those wonderful things, and that was the basis of static civilization. So we can thank beer for our civilization these days.
So when they first thought of this, I've always wondered, how did they refrigerate it?
They didn't.
Ah,
refrigeration
well.
Is a relatively modern concept, and still some places in the world where you don't really get your beer cold unless you specifically ask for it. But no, they didn't refrigerate.
So I could insert my English beer joke here?
Well, yes, but it wouldn't be appropriate because, A, you've detected the accent, and B, the English don't drink the beer warm. Anybody who thinks that 55 Fahrenheit is warm has got a different idea of warmth to me, and that is the classic drinking temperature of ales in the British Isles.
All right. It sounds like we've got a lot to talk about in the next few minutes. I want to kind of bring us up to modern times now. One of the things I didn't know until very recently was this idea, this sort of mishmash of homebrewing laws in the United States. And I did not know until relatively recently that we had President Carter basically to thank for making homebrewing legal again.
He did, yeah. It was Jimmy Carter who signed into law the legislation that allowed home brewing. And a lot of people who had been brewing at home then, quietly, then came out of the closet, as it were, and some of them pretty quickly established commercial operations. And some of the first people to really push for home brewing were people like Charlie Papazian in Boulder, and a number of legendary brewers like Ken Grossman of Sierra Nevada. I mean, they'd been brewing at home quietly, and look what happened to them now, you know, major brewing companies.
And let's look at the state of the sort of the brewing industry back then, because back then when you thought of beer and American beer in particular, you know, you thought of Pabst Blue Ribbon, you thought of Schlitz, you thought of a lot of beers from Wisconsin, but there were a lot of other smaller regional beers too. But they tended to all taste alike in many ways, and it was a very different time in this country beer-wise.
Yeah, it was. There certainly were far fewer breweries. You know, I don't have the precise numbers, but the number 50 springs to mind around that time. And now there are over 2,500 breweries in the United States, and I'm reliably informed there are 1,000 new commercial operations at the planning stage. So, yeah, they're very exciting times. You know, the one thing I always say, of course, is that, you know, there are many great beers in this country, and some of them are long-standing beers, and many people like the traditional English American brews, and that's fine. But equally, there are a lot more beer styles around these days, a lot more choice, and it's an exciting time to be a part of the brewing industry. You've also got to remember that the whole of the craft sector, that will be Boston Beer Company and smaller, amounts to less than 7% of the whole United States brewing business. Imports, they're around 15%. The rest still is the very large brewing companies.
But as I understand, that segment of the market, the sales there are relatively flat, and where you're seeing growth is in some of the craft beers and some of the more specialty brews that are out there.
Absolutely. It's the craft sector that grows healthily every year. But, of course, that is against a comparatively small total volume. So although it might be growing at, I don't know the precise figures at the moment, say 10% a year, that's 10% of a relatively small number. But it is certainly growing, and the big guys recognize that and understand that. But it is the larger volumes, if you like, the total, therefore, in the United States of America is fairly static. And that's because the large guys amount for so much of it.
Now, as we get back to a discussion here of home brewing and kind of bring that back into the conversation, when we look at making a batch of beer in our basement or wherever today, how is that beer different from what we were looking at in the Fertile Crescent 8,000 years ago?
Well, enormously different. I mean, people say, what did it taste like 8,000 years ago? And I always say, well, I'm not sure because I wasn't really there. But, you know, it would have been a very different type of product. The common denominator would have been it contained alcohol. And, of course, it was produced adventitiously. They didn't know that there were yeasts around that were making alcohol. They just recognized that things were happening and changing. And they made a product which gave them a good psychological feeling, if you like. It made them more mellow and relaxed, and it was warming and so on. But taste-wise, it would have been, you know, a little bit malty, possibly, when they, you know, because they were using toasted breads and so on. So there would have been the maltiness, but there certainly wouldn't have been any of the hop character. They probably flavored with certain things. People say they used to use something called mandrake, which is an old plant, but certainly there were no hops around then. So the fundamental difference between beers today and beers back then would have been the hop character.
Has anybody ever found an old recipe on a pyramid or anything and tried to create it?
Yeah. I mean, the most famous one is the hymn to Ninkasi, which is long since been handed down from the days of Sumeria. And if you read the hymn to Ninkasi, and it was translated by a guy called Katz, I believe it in Pennsylvania, but don't quote me on that. He actually unraveled this translation, and there's a guy called Fritz Maytag, who many people know, resurrected the Anchor Brewing Company in San Francisco, and based on that recipe, Fritz Maytag made a beer and created this beer, and it was drunk in a time-honored way with straws, and they drank out of the fermenter, if you like, with straws, a bottle as it was. And I said to Fritz once, what does it taste like? And he said, you know, Charlie, it wasn't very good, but we had a lot of fun making it.
Well, that's half the fun of homebrewing, actually, is making it and discovering new things, isn't it?
I think so. You know, and what I've come to realize in my time in the United States over the years, and as I've been to speak at things like the Homebrewers Association conferences, there's a lot of passionate and very skillful people out there, and they are adamant that they're going to do it well. They're going to produce excellent beer to the highest possible standards, and that certainly can be the case these days.
We're talking about beer. We're talking more specifically about home brewing with Charlie Bamforth for this half hour, among other things known as the Pope of Foam, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about the science behind beer.
And we want to hear from you today. Are you a home brewer? Have you tried it? How'd it go? What has been your best success story as a home brewer? What's been your best, biggest failure? And why do you do it? Give a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Charlie Bamforth for the rest of this half hour, a professor of brewing science at the University of California, Davis. And we're talking with him in part because the state of Mississippi has now passed legislation which legalizes homebrewing beer. And we're talking with Charlie Bamforth about the history of beer, about homebrewing, and all things beer-related. We'll be taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Charlie Bamforth, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the history of beer, and at one point you mentioned that things changed when hops were added to it. Was that just because of the flavor, or did hops bring something else to the game?
Hops brought preservation. And indeed, it's people like St. Hildegard who actually referred to the fact that hops had preservative properties. And so hops bring a lot to the game. They actually have antimicrobial materials. Yes, they do provide bitterness and aroma, but of course that bitterness is also very important for the foam and helps to stabilize the head on the beer. The downside of the bitter compounds is they're sensitive to light, and they break down and give a skunky aroma. And that is why most professional brewers across the world like to package the beer in brown glass, because that keeps a lot of the light out.
And in terms of home brewing, why is it, do you think, that people are attracted to that? I mean, I can, as you mentioned some great brewers before, I can just go down to the local store and for a relatively modest price, I can get a six-pack of some pretty good stuff.
Yes, you can. I think the people are attracted to it because, I mean, it's a skill thing to do. And, of course, throughout the ages, most of the beer that's ever been drunk has been homebrew. And it was mostly brewed by the woman of the house as well, the brewster, through the ages. And, of course, it's fun and it's a challenge. And, of course, at the end of the day, when you're finished, you actually have something which is quite delightful to consume. So, and you can boast to your friends about it. So, you know, there's a lot of passion out there in the world of home brewing. And as I said, a lot of people who study very carefully and want to do the very, very best. And they have some very sophisticated setups at home as well.
Let's go to the phones right now and take some calls from listeners who would like to join in. We begin with Tony, who is from Rhinelander. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you guys today?
We're doing great. How's Rhinelander beer these days?
Well, you know, it's making a comeback.
So I've heard, but you're brewing at home?
I'm brewing at home. Charlie, it's a pleasure to listen to your voice today. I love it when we have these good conversations on the radio.
Thank you.
You know, I've been brewing for probably about 15 years, and I think for me and the group of guys that I brew with here in Rhinelander, the biggest part for us is the camaraderie that we share when we make it. Every winter in February, we go out onto our local lake and we have a big brew fest where we all brew beer at the same time right out on the ice. We do ice fishing, get the grills going. You know, last year it snowed on us. But the camaraderie outweighs anything else. And the quality of the product that we end up with is just spectacular. And, you know, that's what I'd like to say. It's just, it's not any cheaper, but it's a lot more fun.
Tony, you know, the camaraderie thing is very important in brewing at all levels. The, you know, brewers, even the very, very big brewing companies, they get together through organizations like the Master Brewers Association. And on the technical side of brewing companies, there's tremendous goodwill, tremendous interchange, and we love to have meetings all over the world. It's when it gets to the marketing side of things and the sales side that it gets a little bit ruthless. But, of course, you don't get that on the home brewing side, so it's totally camaraderie on that level.
You know, one of the things we hear a lot about during the home brewing stories is that sense of camaraderie. And, you know, they talk about being out on the ice and having a great time and brewing beer. But here in Wisconsin, as you're probably aware, there is a pretty serious drinking culture. And it's different than home brewing and involves drinking too much and doing things that are dangerous. And how do you, you know, bring those two diametrically opposed points together?
It is a great challenge. I covered that in a book I wrote recently, which was all about the middle way and how, you know, beer is like anything, or like most things. There are poles, polarizations. You know, there are people who abuse it, and there are people who are abstemious and are against it. And what I look for is the middle ground, and trying to point out the responsibility that should always go with the drinking of beer. You know, particularly when you're a professor on a university campus, you know, it's certainly very, very important that I spread messages of responsibility. And so the last person in the world to actually suggest that people should throw ping pong balls at glasses of beer is me. I mean, I am heavily against abuse of that nature and drinking for drinking's sake. Drinking of beer or any other alcoholic beverage should be part of a well-balanced lifestyle. And I think anything that can be done to preach that and to go against people treating the product with disrespect is a very important thing to do.
Let's head back to the phones right now. Rich is with us from Franklin. Hi, Rich.
Hello. I have been homebrewing since 1994, and camaraderie is a big part of it. The challenge of being able to make an outstanding beer. I look at it a lot, you know, when people say you can go to the store and buy a great six-pack of beer. Well, yeah, now you can. You really couldn't do that 25 years ago, but it's like bread. You know, a lot of the same ingredients. You know, most of the people in the world, or in the U.S., still eat white bread. But, you know, I like a little rye and pumpernickel now and then. I like the different things that I can do as a home brewer, the different ingredients, the things like that, and again, sharing it. Most of the beer that I make gets shared. You know, I drink very little of it. So that's what, you know, I get out of it. And we have a very vibrant community in Milwaukee. So I'm a member of a club called the Beer Barons of Milwaukee, and we're very involved not only in educating about beer, but the judging of beer. For instance, we have a contest coming up, homebrewing contest, at the end of this month for German Fest, that if you enter a beer into this and it gets, wins the competition, one of the local brewers will ramp it up and make it a commercial beer.
Oh, that sounds great, Rich. Thanks so much for sharing that. Let's move on to Dave, who also joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Dave.
Hey there. Love the show, and I just wanted to call in that we've got a number of friends that do home brewing. It's the greatest thing in the world when they get done with the batch. They want you to come over, try out their newest creation. But one thing that I've heard, anyways, is that how in Western Europe, and they brought all their recipes over from there to the Americas, it was all really, really dark beer because they had less food over there, and they used it for sustenance, and then now the alcohol kept it good for longer periods of time. In America, we have had more food, so we came up with a lighter beer, so because it was more of a drinking thing and not so much of a sustenance thing. And just would like to know if that's true and tell your thoughts on it.
Well, let's ask a professor, Charlie Bamforth.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I think it's probably a mixture of stories and theories that are in there. Certainly in Europe and places like Germany, they used to refer to beer as liquid bread. Having said that, also in Germany, they had the Reinheitsgebot, the purity law, which, of course, in those days, before they knew about yeast, insisted you could only use barley, hops, and water. One of the arguments for that was also to preserve other cereals like rye for making into bread. In terms of the first beers coming over here, then they certainly will. The first beers, of course, would have been English ale-type products. And then as the growth of the Germanic community and the great German brewers, of course, they would have brought over or brought the Germanic lager-style products. And that's why in cities like Milwaukee, there's this great German brewing heritage because of the storage, the ice and the cold and the lagering, which means lager means to store. But gradually, the lighter-flavored products emerged. progressively over here, but I'm not convinced that it necessarily was directly linked to food.
All right, another call from Milwaukee, and Alan joins us. Good afternoon.
Hi, Dr. Bamford. It's a pleasure.
How are you?
I began brewing in the 1970s, and the things we were making then were just god-awful, with bottles exploding in the middle of the night. But in the 1990s, I got quite sophisticated with it. And my oldest son was a student of yours at Davis, Jesse, who he didn't major in brewing, or he majored in American Studies and with a minor in religion, but he's gone on to start Almanac Brewing in San Francisco.
All right, yeah, yeah.
So you had quite an influence on him.
Remember him, yeah.
What's that?
I remember him, yes. Very good.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I remember my him youngest very well. I remember sharing a beer with him once, yeah.
I'm sure. My youngest son went on to become a finalist in the great in the long shot competition of Boston Brewing. So,
Brewing heritage there. Charlie Bamforth, before we leave, we've got about 2 minutes or so left. Let's say somebody's been listening to this and they've been thinking about doing some home brewing on their own. Is it expensive? Is it hard to do? And what do I need if I want to get started?
No, not particularly expensive. I always say there are four requirements. The first is attend to hygiene. Make sure everything's absolutely clean. Second thing is just double-check the hygiene. Third is be absolutely scrupulously clean and make sure you've checked out the hygiene. And fourth, whoever you live with, whoever you partner with, whatever, make sure they share your enthusiasm. You need to have a very understanding friend or partner, because it will become an obsession, or it could very easily become an obsession, and may occupy a very large amount of space. And, you know, when you're boiling wort and doing all these things, there are certain smells associated with it as well. And so everybody in the household needs to be passionate about it, in my opinion.
And it sounds like everybody needs to be clean, too.
Yeah. Well, that is the number one thing that goes wrong with people homebrewing. You know, beer is relatively resistant to spoilage, and certainly no pathogens will grow in beer. But in the raw materials of beer, the process stream, the wort and so on, and even the beer itself, you can get organisms growing that will spoil the flavor very easily.
Well, words to live by. Charlie Bamforth, thanks so much for joining us.
My absolute pleasure.
Charlie Bamforth has been with us for the past half hour or so, professor of brewing science at the University of California, Davis. He is also known as the Pope of Foam.
Gene, you've done a little brewing yourself, right?
I have. I specialize in brown ales, which is like the easiest possible thing in the world to brew, and I highly recommend it.
Strangely, I've never had the opportunity to try it. You've never served us here at WPR, probably for the best legally. Coming up next, we'll talk to a retired businessman who says a mine is needed to address unemployment in northern Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.